Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to Kotaku Split Screen, the only podcast that's vapor-cooled for your enjoyment. It's November 9th, 2017, and we have got a guest-packed episode for you this week. First, Jason and I discuss the news of the week, including Blizzard's announcement of World of Warcraft Classic, the death of the Nintendo Miiverse, and industry layoffs and what Jason really means when he says the games industry is unsustainable. Then we're joined by Zach Barth, creative director of Zachtronics, to talk about his terrific new game Opus Magnum and what it's like running a small niche indie studio. Last, we'll be joined by Kotaku's Mike Fahey to talk about the Xbox One X, which he just reviewed. There's a whole lot to talk about, from pixel counts to the state of capitalism in the West. Let's get to it. Welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen. My name is Kirk Hamilton. I am the editor-at-large at Kotaku.com, and I am joined, as ever, by Kotaku News editor Mr. Jason Schreier. Hello, Jason. It's nice to see you. How are you doing?
Hello, Kirk. I bought a new video game console this week to celebrate the launch of the most powerful console ever.
Did you now? I feel like there's some sort of a punchline coming here, but I'm just going to say, so you bought an Xbox One X?
No, I bought a Nintendo Switch, a second Nintendo Switch, as a surprise for my lovely fiance who has been stealing my Switch all year to play Zelda, so I figured I'd just get her own.
That's probably a good idea. And now you can transfer your save now, so that's also something nice that you can do.
You can? I thought you couldn't.
Yeah, you can transfer saves now. You can transfer profiles over.
I thought it was the whole thing. Like, you can't transfer individual saves, can
you? Yeah, but you could transfer, I believe, your whole profile with her save over, right, to her Switch, and then she could just delete whatever she wants off of her Switch.
Interesting. Oh, maybe I'll figure out if I can do that, because I told her she was disappointed that she couldn't get her Zelda file, but I was like, now you have an excuse to start a new game of Zelda, and she kind of wanted to do that. So we shall see.
That is a very nice gift, though. Good job.
It's just funny that everybody's talking about, or it's funny that Microsoft wants everybody talking about the Xbox One X.
Are they? Is everyone?
Yeah, I don't know that they are. I think we still have a lot more people talking about Mario. But it's still it's just so funny. And we'll talk about this later in the show with Mike Fahey, who's going to come on and talk to us about the Xbox One X. But this graphical arms race is so irrelevant when all we are, the games that we care about are the new Mario and Zelda games that came out this year are the best things. Before we get started into the show, did you want to talk about Fave This?
So Fave This week, Gita and a special guest are going to be talking about shitposting, which is very fun. Mm. I think they'll hopefully define shitposting, which I believe I know what that means, but I'm interested to hear what that is. So that'll be up later this week. Also, right before we get started, I just want to say I saw Thor Ragnarok over the weekend. Mm-hmm. That is a really, really good Marvel movie. I did not expect it to be good. I guess I saw people saying, oh, this movie's really good. And I just went on an afternoon and saw it. Dude, that movie's hilarious. It's directed by the guy who directed What We Do in the Shadows, which I also didn't know about it. And it's maybe the funniest Marvel movie ever. It's at least as funny as Guardians of the Galaxy 1. Hilarious. At multiple times, the whole theater was laughing so hard that we couldn't hear what anyone was saying. So recommended if you want just sort of a very fun action-packed, but mostly joke-packed romp.
I was planning on seeing it this weekend because of your recommendation and others and all the good reviews.
Funny movie.
So I'm looking forward to that. I've also been watching Stranger Things Season 2, which we talked about the other day, and I'll wait to really get into it until I finish it, but so far...
Not feeling it.
Disappointed.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. I feel like for some reason that doesn't surprise me. But yeah, maybe we can talk about it on the pod once you finish.
Yeah, maybe we'll do a segment once I finished it. Why don't we get into the news? Because we have a lot of stuff. We have a jam-packed episode. Two different interviews coming this episode. But first, we will talk about the news of the week, as always. So why don't we get into it? All right, news item number one. Over the weekend, Blizzard held their annual BlizzCon event, which is their whole festival dedicated to all things Warcraft, Starcraft, Diablo, Overwatch. There wasn't much Diablo this year, though. But there were some interesting announcements, including Starcraft 2 going free-to-play, which I believe was one of my predictions at the beginning of this year. So,
yes, you believe. Yeah, you're not. It's not that immediately as that was announced, you were in my DM saying, oh my God, my prediction came true. No, you think maybe that was one of your predictions. Yes, that was definitely one of your predictions. So good job on
that. I think you would do the same thing. If Donald Trump 100%. Gets caught in a video game scandal, you will be in my DM saying
before
the same
I thing. Even have reacted to anything else, that will be true, 100%.
But so the news I might wanted to discuss is, I think, the most interesting one, which is that Blizzard is making World of Warcraft Classic, which is going to be their version of the legacy servers that have become so popular and controversial over the past couple of years. So they didn't give any details on this other than a brief trailer, and they said that they basically said it's going to be a while before we see it.
Yeah.
So we might have to wait 2 or 3 years. But I think it's really interesting, and it's just a really interesting idea. There are a lot of interesting elements to it because, A, the idea of video game preservation, and this is Blizzard's attempt to preserve an original version of a game that you can no longer access anymore. It would be like Bungie coming out and being like, we're going to put out Vanilla Destiny and it'll have the Loot Cave and Peter Dinklage as Ghost and all that stuff. And B, it's interesting that Blizzard saw all the feverish interest in the unofficial servers like Nostalrius, which they shut down, and others that have popped up over the past couple of years and said, hey, people want this. We should do it too. And essentially this is like World of Warcraft Classic, and all these legacy servers are based on different early versions of the game before all the expansion packs. I don't know exactly which one this will be. They haven't said, but it will be interesting to see. Do you think you will play it? And what do you think of this news?
Well, I don't know if I'll play it. Maybe I'll check it out, but I'm not a big WoW person and never have been, but I'm very interested in this news. I think that this is an interesting thing, and I think that the reaction to it has been very interesting. Cecilia posted a really cool article getting the reactions of the people who ran those independent sort of underground servers, and you know, a lot of them describing very emotionally what it was like for them to hear that this is going to come back after, you know, their own servers had been shut down. And I think it's very interesting. On a human level. I relate it to Destiny a little bit because, you know, I've been playing Destiny 2 and now I'm sort of playing it on PC and really watching the community sort of dissolve into negativity. There's just a lot of, people are upset about a lot of fair things about Destiny 2 that they don't like. And a lot of the discussion has been, remember this in Destiny 1, or boy, I really miss, especially people talking about the Crucible. I miss so much that, you know, that one hand cannon meta that was happening during House of Wolves. And people saying, you know, if I'll see posts on Destiny the game now on the subreddit saying, hey, if you want to have fun, Mayhem Rumble is going on right now on Destiny 1. That playlist is up and you can just go play that if you want.
And interesting.
And it's got me thinking a couple things. One is that it's totally understandable that you would want to go back and play, you know, an old version of a game that you played a lot of in the day and had a lot of fun with. And these games do just become unrecognizable.
Have nostalgia for.
Yeah, and the games become unrecognizable over time. And it's not like those games weren't fun. It's not like they're just entirely better and they should just replace and wipe away the old version. Also, I think, and especially with a game like WoW that's so old at this point, it's partly that you look back and you want to revisit that time in your life, right? I mean, that's kind of how nostalgia works. And that's certainly true with video games. And I've had this feeling, so I didn't play World of Warcraft, but I have had this feeling with Destiny, the feeling of looking back at who I was and what was going on in my life in 2014, in the fall of 2014, when Destiny launched, and how different things are now, and how, you know, in so many ways my life is so much better, actually in a lot of the ways that lead me to not have as much time for Destiny. Like, I am not, like, fresh off of a breakup and sort of, you know, primed to just sit there and play some game where numbers climb forever, and I'm, you know, in a different place in my life, and I just have other stuff going on, so that's kind of better. But I also do think back to, man, I miss that feeling feeling of abandon or that feeling of just letting myself go into this new world and this new game. And I'm sure people feel that way about World of Warcraft. And it must be so cool to just get to do that, or the prospect of getting to do that, to go back to what it was like when you first got this game and you first were playing it and just thought, holy shit, I can't believe this. So I think that's all very interesting and very cool. I'm glad they're doing it.
Yeah, I was into World of Warcraft for a little while, way back in the day, in like 2005, before any of the expansions. So I would be curious to see this, although I don't have any desire to go back to the game and revisit any of those feelings, because I don't know. I think World of Warcraft can be a very unhealthy game to play. It can have a lot of really negative impact. I mean, so can Destiny, but I think Destiny is easier to stop, easier to... the commitment level is a lot lower.
Yeah, they're pretty different. They're
than
different.
It was back then. Yeah, and I like had some unhealthy habits with raiding and in World of Warcraft back in the day with 40-man raids. But I would be curious, just for a nostalgia purpose, to go back and be like, oh my god, I remember this. So I think, depending how they present the World of Warcraft Classic, I think I would check it out, especially if it doesn't have a monthly subscription, if it's free to play or something like that.
Yeah, that would definitely be a boon for me, just because the idea of paying a bunch of money to play it makes me think, I'll just do something else. But yeah, if it's very easy to get into and just try out, totally I'll do it, especially because I'm sure there are people like me who didn't play World of Warcraft but are curious. And
right.
I do. I
and
generally,
it's very intimidating now.
Yeah, I feel
in.
A little bit put off by the game now, even though I know it's probably more accessible than ever, and they've gotten very good at onboarding new people, and there's so much content that you just could play forever and not run out of stuff to do. I would like to go back to what it was like for people who were starting out and see that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's cool. I'm into it.
Yeah, I mean, if you think organizing a 6-person raid is hard, imagine organizing a 40-person raid.
Yeah.
I remember there were all these systems for like how you would get into the raid, and you could sign up for spots, but also oftentimes, because to get 40 people organized would be so hard, these clans, the big raiding clans, would have more than 40 people all come on, and then you would have to kind of vie for spots.
Oh,
like,
man.
Bid,
it's like picking teams in gym.
Mm-hmm. And then also people would make up these fake loot systems called DKP. I don't remember what that stands for. Maybe like dragon kill points. And basically everyone would have a certain amount of DKP and you would have to bid on it. And this was all outside of the game itself. It was like a system that was just made up by the clans. And every time loot dropped, because loot wasn't individualized, it was shared collectively.
Right.
So you would have to bid on that loot. And I remember getting so excited when I got my first piece of raid loot. It was just a crazy, like, just such an endorphin rush. I remember doing the raid for the first time. Another thing about 40-person raids is that it's a lot easier to, hide people who aren't great as opposed to a 6-person raid where everyone has to pull their weight.
Which is something that I would actually think would be a little more challenging. Because in Destiny, we've all been in the situation where one person is, like, not getting it done, and then it gets very awkward.
No. I'm saying it's easier to hide someone. Like, not everyone has to execute perfectly the way they do in Destiny.
Yeah, that's what
I'm
saying.
In a WoW raid.
So it's in a... No, I'm saying the same thing. In a Destiny raid, when you have one of your people is not really pulling their weight, it's a real problem, and it can get very socially awkward, even, where you're kind
everyone's
getting fed up with this one person, even though you love them, but they're blowing it. Where in a WoW raid, with 40 people, I can't imagine that if one person goes down in an opportune moment, it doesn't cost you, the last 30 minutes of progress in the same way.
Yeah, so I am very curious. This is the first news that has made me interested in, because I'm not super interested. I played some Final Fantasy 14, and even that, it's just such a huge time sink that I can't really sink into it the way that I maybe wish I could. All right, news item number two, Nintendo's Miiverse social network, which was a big part of the Wii U and even had some elements on the 3DS, shut down this week. And we had known this was coming. Nintendo announced it a while back, but this was the official end to Miiverse. So Miiverse essentially was a place where, like, a message board / area where you could share screenshots and draw diagrams of your games and stuff like that. And it was just basically a Nintendo-focused social hub. Had some funny memes, some interesting stuff. I don't know if people used it to seriously network with people, but it was definitely amusing. amazing. Kirk, did you use the Miiverse? Will you miss the Miiverse? How do you feel about this?
So I didn't really use the Miiverse. I was never big with my Wii U. I consider that console to be maybe my least used or appreciated console that I've owned. I think the Miiverse was a cool idea. I've, of course, followed it. And I think the Miiverse lives on, at least in Splatoon 2, in a way that I think is really cool. This is something that we discussed on our Splatoon 2 episode mm-hmm. a while back when we left you behind to talk about that game. But that's something that that game does that I think is really cool.
Rest in peace, me.
Is it mixes in these funny memes and these funny drawings, and there are all kinds of propaganda wars going on that are both like thematically consistent with Splatoon 2 as a game, and then also just really entertaining and really funny and kind of spill out of the game and onto Twitter. Mm-hmm. The Miiverse is actually almost feels designed for Twitter and was almost ahead of its time in terms of the way that Twitter has become such an essential way for people playing games to communicate. And Splatoon, of course, I'll see Splatoon 2 drawings everywhere on Twitter. So I think that it's a really cool idea. I hope that Nintendo is working on whatever the next weird idea is, even if it winds up just being that some of their games work like Splatoon 2, where they have their own sort of centralized Miiverse, which is kind of what Splatoon has, and it isn't a thing that goes outside of that. Just because I think it was a cool idea, I always liked the way that it organically fit into the Wii homepage, and it's just sort of there in the background if you don't want to participate, but it still informs your experience in a way that's kind of neat. So I hope
it felt like with the Switch, they were trying to move past the idea of Miis entirely.
Yeah, that's true.
Because that's such a Wii U, 3DS thing.
Maybe. Or it could well be that they're not moving beyond those things. They just haven't figured out they haven't finalized what they're going to do with them. Because, you know, sure. Steven Totello, our boss, has pointed this out many times, that the Switch does feel like a very cold system, which I think is true. Mm-hmm. The operating system isn't very exciting. It doesn't have that Nintendo playfulness that I actually really like, which isn't bad, especially if that was a result of a sort of back to basics, let's just make the operating system run well and make everything work approach, and then start adding that stuff and hopefully not slow everything down. Side note, I know we're going to talk about the Xbox One X later with Fahey, but something that really happened to the Xbox was the operating system just got slower and slower and slower, and then finally this most recent update made it fast again. But if something like that happened with the Switch, that would bum me out, where they start adding bells and whistles, but then it just takes forever for everything to load.
Oh no, yeah, that would be terrible.
But it would be cool. I hope they're planning some kind of, you know, not Street Pass, not necessarily Miiverse, but those sorts of weird Nintendo-y ideas for the Switch, because I would like the Switch to have a little more personality, and that seems like a way they could do it.
Agreed, hopefully. All right, final bit of news. So this is a big one. So over the past week, Runic Games, the makers of Torchlight and Hob, shut down. Motiga, the makers of the game Gigantic, essentially shut down, mostly laid off, although they're keeping a core staff around. Perfect World, the publisher of both of these games, is keeping a core team around to still work on the game. And then Telltale, the infamous adventure game creators behind The Walking Dead and many others.
Well known, maybe. They're not necessarily infamous to everybody. People like those games.
Laid off about 90 staff, or 25% of their employees. They had about 400 people, which is a lot. It all leads to the question, is the video game industry unsustainable? Which is something that I've been saying for a little while now.
Yes. So this is, I have questions for you about this. Obviously, these layoffs are a bummer. We've seen layoffs like this before. It seems like a pretty familiar narrative almost by now. And I know that Telltale in particular had restructured and said they're restructuring earlier this year, and this has sort of been a long time coming. So you say, you say the video game industry is unsustainable, and I'm curious what that means.
So when I talk about unsustainability in the video game industry, I am mostly talking about work conditions, and I'm mostly talking about the idea that right now we have an industry that is so full of crunch, which I've written about many times before, basically long overtime hours, unpaid overtime, horrible 100-hour weeks for weeks, if not months on end. That it feels to a lot of people like it's a young person's game. And a lot of people have, once they hit their 30s or 40s and they have kids and they have a spouse and they want to spend time at home with their families, they just move on and they leave for other fields. They leave for more lucrative software development where you don't have to put in nearly as many hours and you get paid more, or other fields like that. And I've seen there are no numbers on this because it's impossible to find numbers for number of senior devs who have burnt out. But anecdotally, I've heard a lot of stories about this. I've heard a lot of stories about game companies having a hard time filling these senior level positions. And it seems like there's a dearth of experience. And I think that video game publishers by nature just have this short-sighted approach where it's always about like, what's the next 3 months going to be? What's the next financial quarter? What's the next year going to look like? And there's not a lot of thought given to the future health, the overall long-term health of the video game industry, because it's always about, we got to ship this next game. Like, everything's on fire here. We can't think about the long term. Sorry, guys, but we're going to have to ask you to come work like late this week. It doesn't matter. Like, we're not even thinking about whether you're burning out. And there's a lot of mismanagement and a lot of kind of systemic issues facing the video game industry. I don't necessarily think that this is all going to lead to some sort of crash, but I do think that it's going to affect the video game industry in a lot of intangible ways, that to the point where those effects might even be invisible to us. Like, we won't know when a game comes out and it feels uninspired or it's super buggy and crashes all the time. We don't know what kind of factors went into that, but probably a big part of it is lack of senior staff, lack of experience, lack of people who have been there for 20 years and know how to do things efficiently and know how to avoid crunch. And that leads to more crunch. And then it becomes this whole just terrible, vicious cycle of the industry taking all these young, hopeful people, because there's a never-ending stream of young people who are like, oh, hell yeah, I want to work on video games. And we'll go into the industry and taking them and just chewing them up and spitting them out. And then they just leave because they're totally fried after working in the game industry for another pasture. And then it just continues. And so the overall age will just continue to be young. There will be this overall lack of experience and talent. And I mean, I don't know where it's headed. I don't really like prognosticating about the future and doomsaying about what might happen and what kind of crashes might happen or what kind of companies might collapse. But it just feels like there's so many people who are just mistreated. And in the case of Runic and Motika and Telltale, it's a lot of people who were crunching their asses off, especially with Telltale. That place, from what I've heard, was just a nightmare to work at, just constant crunch, because think about their output. They release so many friggin' episodes every year. And to crunch nonstop only to be told, oh yeah, you're being let go next week, is just like unfathomable. There's just so many like layoff cycles and studio closures, and we saw Visceral and many more layoffs and studio closures throughout the year. It just happened every single year. There's just a new batch, and it just feels like something's got to give. You know what I mean?
I do. I guess I wrestle with the word unsustainable only because the word unsustainable suggests to me that it is a prediction unto itself. When something is unsustainable, that means that it's eventually going to break and there's going to be some kind of a rupture. And that's what I struggle to get my head around. And I agree with you that
I do think, yeah, I guess I think it'll be in more subtle ways than some sudden apocalypse.
So I see the video game industry as being very volatile. I think it's a particularly volatile sector of the tech industry. And I think that some of the stuff that you're describing is true across the board at a lot of different technological, like tech companies, especially in the startup world where it's very, very, you know, there's a lot of crunch, there's a lot of mismanagement, there's a lot of young
teams. That's a lot more lucrative.
Well, sure, but I mean, but there are a lot of those symptoms you're describing, right?
And no, but that makes a big difference. I mean, if you're working for a tech company where you're making $150,000 a year plus whatever stock options you might get, then it's a lot more palatable to be crunching than if you're working at a video game company where maybe you're making $60,000.
Sure, a year. But I mean, there's a couple things that make me just sort of question the idea of like specifically of unsustainability are one. The idea that video games are selling so many copies and are making so much money. It seems like the industry itself is unhealthy, at least. It doesn't seem like it's healthy for an industry to have such a hit-oriented model.
Yeah, so that's another component of this, is that these game publishers are concerned less with making a steady stream of revenue every year and more with growth, because in Wall Street, it's all about what are your numbers compared to last year's numbers and what's the quarter over quarter growth. And it's that kind of capitalistic, like intensely growth focused vision that is making these companies make decisions like, hey, we got to focus on two games a year and they both have to be these massive service games. And that's the only way we're going to be able to.
And they both have to be hits, right?
I mean,
there's
targets,
there's a very winner take all aspect to this, where you either had the biggest game of the month or you lost. And so many games are either, okay, this was one of the biggest games of the year, or this was a sales failure. So that strikes me as unhealthy. And all of the layoffs and the fact that it's very hard to have a consistent job strikes me as volatility. And unhealthiness and volatility are both not great things. The question of sustainability, I guess, is just like a harder one for me to get my head around, because I feel like so much of our financial system and our culture is unhealthy and volatile, and like Western capitalism is volatile and unhealthy.
Yeah,
so I don't know.
We're getting into bigger subjects there.
It is. But I think that it's interesting. And I think that when you start talking about this, I don't know. I'd be curious to know more about how this stuff relates and to see more numbers about whether it really is unsustainable or whether it isn't, because there probably is a bottom line way to figure that out, just purely economically, whether this is a sustainable thing that's happening right now or whether it isn't. And that kind of goes beyond some of those human conditions you're talking about and just comes down to money and how much this stuff costs versus how much this stuff brings in. And the sense that I get is that video games are an extremely profitable industry. And that, to me, does not say unsustainable.
Well, that's the thing. Video games are a profitable industry if you're in the right type of video game at the right time.
Right.
I mean, look at Zynga. Zynga went from being the most profitable company in the world and having Farmville, this instant like cash machine, to a shell of itself.
That's very volatile. That strikes me as volatility. That is what that is, right?
I don't know, because you see a lot of these companies closing, and you see a lot of another aspect that I haven't brought up yet is the oversaturation of the marketplace and how so many more video games are released every single week these days, as opposed to even a year or two ago. And that, to me, I mean, that's one of the signs that a crash might be coming, because that is one of the reasons that there was that big crash in 1984, was just a glut of video games. Granted, the main reason for that is because most of those were bad.
Yeah, that's a pretty big difference. that's a significant difference.
That's the thing. It's like we're getting to this point where it's just a system that is just not working, and too many people are releasing great games and just not making any money off of them.
I'm trying to think, though, if there is an example.
There's just this collection of wealth in these big hits.
Sure, but I'm trying to think if there's an example of any crash that's ever happened where there was too much good stuff being created and that led to a crash. That just doesn't seem to me, as a non-economist, and maybe somebody can write in and tell me if there's an example of this. There may well be in history, but as a non-economist, I see that and I just don't see the makings of a crash where there's so much awesome shit to choose from. There's like an oversaturation of amazingness. And yeah, the last video game crash was because there was an oversaturation of trash, and that's a way, that's an empty market. That's a very different problem.
No, that's totally true. Yeah, I mean, I didn't mean to, I don't want to be saying, like I said before, I'm not trying to predict a crash here. Like, I don't want to be prognosticating. I think that it's unsustainable because I don't think that this current rate is working for a lot of people, and I think it's going to drive a lot of people out of the industry if it hasn't already. I mean, that's the maybe you're seeing the word unsustainable as thinking that like the sustainability is the video game industry as a whole, but I'm seeing the part that's unsustainable is the current state of things. Like, I can see in 5 to 10 years the landscape being totally different, whether that means that suddenly we only have two or three video game publishers, or like a lot fewer independent developers, a lot fewer middle ground developers, a lot fewer people like, I don't know, just that level of studio like Arcane, where they spend 3 years and Lord knows how much money making a game like Prey, and then nobody buys it. So that to me is like, it's such a risky business. It just seems like all of these factors are combining to something that is like, yeah, it feels like so something has to give. I don't think that that's going to be a crash. I think it's going to be just, I don't know, an overhaul, a revolution of some sort.
The distinction you're making is, instead of saying maybe the video game industry is itself unsustainable, which suggests that the video and game industry will itself break at some point under the weight of that unsustainability, you're saying more the state of things as they are right now. The current state of the video game industry is unsustainable.
Yeah, I feel like that's implied, like in brackets.
Well, okay, but I mean, that's like
the current state of...
It's a worthy distinction, though. It's a worthwhile distinction to make for the sake of clarity.
Point. Agreed. Yes, the current state of things seems unsustainable to me. I think that game developers need to figure out, I mean, if they want to stay game developers and if they want to work under healthier conditions, I think the only real option is unionization. Like, mm-hmm. I think that has to happen, and it can start small, maybe at one company it starts, like in an independent company, or maybe one a group of people, like, I don't know, concept artists all decide to band together, or like artists or like programmers or something like that. That just seems like the only way to take the power back, because right now, I mean, there are a ton of profits in the video game industry, and they are all going to a very small group of people, the executives on top, who are grinding their workers to the desk. Yes,
sounds,
and that's like a very American capitalism. Yes, yeah. That's a problem of capitalism as a whole. But there are ways to fight that, and at least fight for a larger part of the pie, and at the very least fight for like work conditions that aren't going to kill you or like cost you your family time.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and just a bit of a tangent there.
Yeah, but a little bit of a rah-rah. I do think that would be it would be a good thing to do. Just
it's just so impractical because there's so many different video game companies and so many different people with so many different opinions on things, and it's a lot harder to organize than. I mean, I just don't see the logistical possibilities of it as much as I think it needs to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But
you know,
yeah,
that's up
I mean,
to the person who comes up with the solution to the logistical problems. You know, that's that there could well be someone to do that. And it would be cool, I think, just having as someone in an industry where we did organize, it definitely it's definitely a good thing to do.
Yes,
for
it has helped us. It has helped protect us through a lot of things and kept us some of our benefits that we enjoy. And it's been
kept
only
us together.
Good
let
for
us keep making a podcast for all of you to listen to.
Yeah. You think we wouldn't be together without our union?
Well, I guess that's not true. I think we would be, but it's helped us keep together at Kotaku and
and
keep doing this exact podcast.
Sure. Anyway, all right. So we got a few different interviews to bring in.
We do.
First, we are going to bring on Zach Barth, who we will talk to shortly, and then after that, go right into Michael Fahey to talk about the Xbox One X.
Very exciting.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we will bring on Zach.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hey, I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And we're the hosts of Lifehacker's podcast, The Upgrade. On The Upgrade, we help you improve your life one week at a time. We talk to guests like former hacker Hector Monsegur about online security.
You need to be aware of how you could be attacked. You need to be aware of what's your weakness.
And Alan Alda on how to communicate more effectively.
And in order to achieve that, we start with teaching exercises derived from improvisation.
And sex therapist Steven Snyder about how to have great sex in a long-term relationship.
What really works under those circumstances is if you enjoy the other person selfishly.
Hey, your life? It's terrible. We can help.
Find The Upgrade wherever you get your podcasts.
We are here right now with indie developer Zach Barth, who is the creative director of Zachtronics. And you probably know him if you know him from some of his games, which include Space Chem, Infiniminer, and the most recent release, Opus Magnum, which is ridiculously addictive. Zach, thank you so much for being here. Hello, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I am glad to have you here because I just picked up Opus Magnus and started playing it, and now I can't stop to the point where I just spent an hour at work playing it and probably shouldn't have, and I hope Steven Totillo isn't listening to this and doesn't find out that I just played an hour at work. Tell us a little bit about Opus Magnum, because I'm guessing a lot of people have not heard of it.
Yeah, so Opus Magnum is a, I mean, I guess at this point you could almost call it a Zachtronics-style puzzle game, but that sounds a little
you
conceited. Have a
style, you get your own genre. Yeah.
Only because it's difficult to describe. So the thing that makes our puzzle games different from other puzzle games is that they don't have like a single solution. A lot of puzzle games tend to have like a single solution, and then it's your job to recreate that single solution that like the designer came up with. But our puzzle games are very open-ended. We give you a challenge, and then we give you tools, and then it's completely up to you how you want to tackle that. And so Opus Magnum is a game in this style. It is about alchemy, kind of, ostensibly. It's about alchemy, but in a
sure.
very...
Like, it's really about moving things around.
It's really about moving things around, about building... Like, it's alchemy at a molecular level. And so it's... You take compounds that you're given... It doesn't sound exciting when you describe it at the alchemy part. You build machines. So you build,
machines. It reminds me of The Incredible Machine, the old PC game.
Fantastic Contraption, right?
It's kind of like those, except you're building a machine not just to run once and do something. Like, a lot of those games are inspired by Rube Goldberg machines, where you just hit play and it runs and that's it. In all of our, like, Zachtronics-style puzzle games, you build a machine that has its own job. So you're building a machine that builds stuff, and, like, a specific kind of thing. And then when you run your machine, maybe it, like an Infinifactory, it cranks out like furniture for your alien overlords, or in Opus Magnum or in Space Chem, you build a machine that cranks out chemicals, compounds that, you know, fit into the plot in some way.
And so you guys are a really small team. It's like four of you?
Is that right? Opus Magnum was five core team.
Five of you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's super small for a video game. How are you guys able to make such an interesting, complicated game with such a small team?
Oh, we just do the stuff we're good at, right? I think in addition to having a small team, we also try to turn out games pretty quickly. So Opus Magnum was about like 8 or 9 months from start to finish.
Wow.
I mean, we're in early access, but we're almost done with that too. So very, very short game development in total. I think we try to stick to the stuff that we're good at. Like, it's very easy to say, oh, I've got this great cinematic vision for this game, and then just get really like bogged down in trying to create cutscenes and all this content that's expensive and not something we can create easily. We don't do that. We just focus on, you know, what do we need to tell the story? What do we need for this to be a great game? What are we good at making? Let's make stuff that we're good at making.
Yeah, not a lot of voice acting from celebrities in this game.
No, there is writing in this game. We should say that friend of the podcast, Matthew Burns, works for you and was responsible, I think, for the writing and the music on this game.
Yeah.
Right? Which is
and the sound, yeah.
Another cool split-screen listeners will know that. I have so many questions about this game. One thing you're in the description that I think, if people haven't played this game, I would kind of describe this as a slightly computer programmery game in a way that you're writing routines for these machines to perform. So It actually reminds me, I'm not a computer programmer, but it reminds me of when I was learning to use Adobe Flash a really long time ago, and I was doing keyframe animation, and I had no idea what I was doing, and I got this book that was sort of like how to write basic animation in Flash, and you kind of start working along a timeline and then learn over time, oh, I'm being really inefficient in my way of, you know, achieving this thing, and you start to kind of realize the shortcuts you can take. And this game has that. You assign an arm, and then you tell the arm that it's going to do in this, you know, you're moving along a timeline that everything is moving along, and you're writing kind of scripts. I mean, is that a fair description, would you say, describing this sort of as a programmery game?
So one way to reduce a lot of our games is to say that they're about parallel programming. And I think it's kind of funny. A lot of people make programming games, and a lot of them are really boring. And I think that a source of what makes our games interesting is that they're not just about like sequential programming, like a Lightbot kind of game, but they're always about parallel programming. And in Opus Magnum, you have to program a bunch of arms, a bunch of little mechanical arms that can rotate and grab things and move them. You have to program them all to move in concert. And one of the things that we sort of developed for Opus Magnum was the timeline. And it actually, you can see all of the, like, each of the arms is a row, and your programs, like, each arm has a program that extends to the right, but since those rows are stacked, you sort of see this big grid that becomes like a timeline. It's not unlike like After Effects or Premiere, you know, or Flash, like any kind of like layered editing over time software. And it's definitely, it's not an accident that you're thinking that, right? Like, it's inspired by that timelines like that are a way to solve a challenging problem that we needed to solve.
Yeah, it's like composing a piece of music, and you have all these different instruments that are playing, and you can play with when each one starts.
Right, and like working in Logic or working in a sort of sequencing program, which actually does a grid-based sequence instead of just recording instruments. It really has that sort of satisfying feeling. I talk to myself a lot when I'm playing this game. I sit there just saying out loud, okay, so I need to put this here, and then this does that. And I wind up realizing, you know, I live alone now, but I'm realizing that I'm sort of just talking to myself and having these long conversations.
That's a common feature of Kirk's life.
It really inspires it.
Yell at video games constantly.
So I'm interested, Zach, in the fact that there is writing, and I actually am kind of interested in your take on this, even though I know we could ask Matthew about this, but this game sort of has a world, and it has this really neat art and these characters. You're playing as this precocious student who then becomes an alchemist in the world, and there's kind of a, I really like the writing, which makes sense. I like Matthew and I like his writing. But what was the thought process there in giving this game a fictional world? I know all of your games have kind of had that. I feel like this one's maybe a little bit different than that. But what was your process in coming up with that?
So Matthew's been working with us. He wrote the story for TIS 100, Shenzhen.io, and Opus Magnum. But before that, we also, I mean, like, writing has always been a big focus for Zachtronics games. And even before we had writing, world building was a huge focus. Like, writing is not one of my skills. So going back to our Flash game, like going back to the Flash games that I essentially made by myself, there's not a lot of writing in it, but there's absolutely world building. And that's always been a hugely important thing for me because, you know, I mean, Chris, when you're making a game, all the time you're asking yourself, what goes in this game? What doesn't go in this game? And for me, I guess our games are very gameplay focused. So it looks like that decision might be made by just saying, oh, well, what's fun to play with? But it's really not. Like, I'm sort of like obsessive about making stuff that feels like it really takes place in a world. And even though our games are often about kind of trying to represent fictional engineering systems, like, those engineering systems come from somewhere, and that tells you something about the world, right? Like, it's engineering is not something that happens in a vacuum. It's a direct, you know, like, it's a result of humans trying to solve problems that matter to them. And so that's always been a huge thing in my game design process. When I did Space Chem and sort of scaled up into making it like a commercial, quote-unquote commercial game, I actually got my wife to write the story for me. She was really getting into like fiction writing, and so she wrote the story for Space Chem, for Ironclaw Tactics, and Finifactory. And when she was tired of writing stories for my games, that was when Matthew came on board and then sort of took over that job and has been doing an equally great job. And it's really, a lot of people say like, oh, there's a story in this game, that's strange. But for me, it's like, it'd be weird not to. It would be weird if our games were just a bunch of puzzles with no meaning to them. And it's just like, I can't imagine doing that. It seems just unfathomable to me.
Yeah, there's an enjoyable amount of humor in this game.
Yeah, it's essential. The humor, it's essential. That's another thing you'll find in all of our games, is like sort of this like dark sense of humor that Christ, they'd be so boring if they weren't funny sometimes.
Well, especially the tutorial of this game is very good and sort of walks you in, but it's also delivered side by side with these two characters kind of very dryly and passive aggressively trying to one-up one another, these two students, and I think it just has a really good vibe that kept me going, and I really liked.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about from a design perspective. So you're coming into this and you're thinking, okay, we want a player to be able to build these machines and solve these goals using these tools that we give them. How do you decide which tools to go with and like which tools to would work, which tools wouldn't work, which tools would make the game too easy by just giving them too many, like to make it too unbalanced, too powerful? How do you make those decisions as you're designing the game?
Oh, it's tough. There's not intuition. I think that really is the answer. This is a question that a lot of people ask, and it's like, but there's no real recipe for doing it. And I guess if I was a better game designer, I would say, oh, extensive trial and error and testing stuff. But I've designed a lot of games with these tool sets that you use, and it's largely by intuition. And I'll come up with something in my head. I'll sort of like think about it and simulate it in my head, and it seems pretty apparent like which ones are too overpowered and how they intersect. I think this comes from having like a good intuitive sense of like computational, not real computation, I'm not really that good at computer science, but like just how tools intersect each other and what kind of things can emerge from that and when they're like redundant, you know, like that's one thing, trying to avoid like redundant tools. You want stuff that in the things that are like or functionally orthogonal to each other. And I just sort of have like an intuitive grasp of that. And I use that a lot of times I'm wrong. Right. And so that's where it's important to make something and then be like, oh, this is terrible. Like, you know, I'll probably over design by about like 50 to 100%, which is basically that like if the game has 10 parts in it, I'll design 20, and then like a lot of them will be bad and we'll just kind of cut them down. And same thing with puzzles, right? Make puzzles, throw away the boring ones, throw away the bad ones, throw away the ones that are too easy.
So for Opus Magnum, did you cut it? Did you add any tools that you then had to cut for whatever reason?
Well, some of them didn't necessarily get cut, but got downplayed. Like I don't know if you guys are far enough. It's in chapter 2. We introduce something called a triplex bond, which is like it's a bond that you have to create 3 different ways. And
oh, interesting.
When I first came up with that, I'm like, oh, this is going to be a big thing. But it actually turned out I have a thing when I'm talking about tools and games, the difference between tools that like you can have parts in Opus Magnum that give you new abilities. And then there's also parts in Opus Magnum that apply constraints that like the arms are tool parts, like they're tools, you can use them, you know, and they're useful. And each one of those we give you sort of magnifies the amount of stuff you can do. A bonder is not a tool. It doesn't help you. It just gives you a constraint. It says that, hey, you have to bond these things together. So you're going to have to work this in there somehow and program around it. And in Opus Magnum, we literally separate into 2 different bins, the tools that help you and the tools that get in your way. But and so having a good balance between the two, I think, is important. Like the tools that get in your way allow us to force puzzles to be different, that we can say, here's this weird thing that requires you have to use it in like this, you know, you need specific movement patterns to use this. And so we're going to throw this in there to mix it up and force you to do something new, versus the arms are just sort of always there. And those are the things that you get better at and learn the secrets of and learn how to use them effectively.
I'm curious if, I mean, so this game is in early access, obviously you can still tweak and change it, and you're probably getting to watch more people play it. It sounds like you don't do a huge amount of testing, and you know, if you're from what you're saying, and now all these people are playing it. First off, I guess I want to ask about 2 things. I want to ask about some of the solutions that you're seeing, and then also I just want to ask about the GIFs. So maybe I'll ask about the GIFs first.
Yeah.
Where did the GIF idea come from? So to explain to listeners, this game, you know, you complete a puzzle in this game and it gives you, and you get to watch your machine, you know, generating the solution basically. And it's really elegant and beautiful looking. And then the more intricate your solution, the better looking it is. And then the game gives you the option to create a GIF of that, which is really a mesmerizing looking thing that just drops right on your desktop. And now you have a GIF that you can drop on social media. When I played this game, in fact, I knew about it because Matthew had mentioned, I knew he was making a game. I knew you had a new game coming out. And I then realized when I played it, oh, this is that game that I keep seeing GIFs of on Twitter. So I think it's a really smart idea because people get to see it. What was the genesis of that idea?
Oh, so it's interesting. In Space Chem, actually, you have to go back further. So long time ago, like almost 10 years ago, I made a game called The Codex of Alchemical Engineering. And kind of coincidentally, that's the game upon which Opus Magnum is based. So I made this like really terrible Flash game like 10 years ago that it's impossible to play nowadays by modern standards. But it was really the thing that started the genre of like the Zachtronics games where you assemble stuff. And one of the things I noticed after releasing that game is that people were, I elevated some stuff about, like, this is how many cycles it takes to beat your, you know, to beat, like, a puzzle. And, like, how much time it takes for your solution to run. And I, like, players started on it was on Kongregate, and then, like, on the Kongregate forums, they were competing with each other and saying, like, oh, I shaved another two cycles off of your solution. Oh, look at this one. It's even better. And, like, I had, I failed to implement save load correctly back then. I was really bad at making games. so instead, when you played a level, you could export your solution and, like, keep them in a text file or something, which is a really, that's so dumb. I don't know why I did that. But I guess it was kind of good because people would export their solutions and then share them on the forums to be like, oh, here, I shaved five circles off yours. Here's mine. And then somebody else could take that and then import it into the game. And then they could improve on it then. And so they go back and forth. And so when it came time to do Space Come and do it as a commercial release, I was thinking back to that. And it's like, man, it would be really great if we had like a first class way where in the game someone could share a solution to show a friend like what they've made. And so the original version of this was Space Chem, was something that would, like, you'd push a button in the game and it would, like, dump out a web page image map kind of thing where Space Chem had, like, a meta, like, an overview and then, like, zoom into reactors. And so it would show you the map and you could click on them and then it would switch to, like, a preview picture of the reactors. Right. The problem with this is that it was static. And it turns out that, like, a static Space Chem solution is incomprehensible. You cannot appreciate it when it's not moving. And so looking at that, I was like, you know, it'd be great if we could record a video. And this was when YouTube was sort of big, which is like a quaint thing to say. Like, YouTube was kind of taking off back in 2010 when Space Chem came out. Mm-hmm. And so so I was thinking, you know, it'd be really great if you could just record, like, when you beat a puzzle in game, you push a button, it records a video, and then you type in your YouTube account information, and it just uploads that video straight to YouTube for you. And so we did this, we shipped this, lots of people uploaded YouTube videos, and it was great. A couple years later, when we're working on Infinifactory, you know, it's a similar kind of puzzle game. Infinifactory was kind of like a sequel to Space Chem. And I was thinking, okay, let's do this again. But by that time, like, people weren't really using YouTube in the same way that they were. And, like, Twitter was way bigger. And I was going to, like, I'd actually implemented a video recorder, but we never shipped it because it was kind of pointless.
It would need to have a thumbnail saying, like, you will not believe the solution.
Yeah, with a person's face going, oh, in front of a solution.
Exactly. Yeah. So we built a video recorder for Infinifactory and then canned it. And we were in early access. It'd been a couple weeks, and I was on the Steam forums, and somebody had recorded a GIF of their solution. And so they, like, in a Fraps kind of program or whatever, they captured some footage, and then they edited it to seamlessly loop, which worked because, in these games, you build solutions that loop seamlessly. And they made a GIF that did that. And I took one look at it. It was like, holy shit, this is the greatest thing ever. Within 2 days, I had taken my old video thing that we never shipped and then completely rewritten it to save GIFs. And then we published it. I'm just like, this is it. This is the thing.
Nice.
And we published it, and people loved it. People recorded tons of GIFs. Tons of GIFs got out there on the internet for the game. It seemed like a pretty good promotional thing. So for Opus Magnum, the plan since day one was we're going to make a GIF editor or GIF like exporter. It's going to be like really simple to use. It's going to be branded, obviously, because you want the game's name to be on it. It's going to have your scores baked into it, so it's like a proof of your completion of it. Like it fills like a bunch of roles in the social aspects of this game, and it's been great.
I beat the first one and sort of, I think I did a really, really inelegant solution that was this just massive, like, long chain of actions, and then finished it and then saw my score in the leaderboard and saw that Jason had done a much more efficient solution than me. And of course said, okay, well, now I'm going to go beat Jason's score, and went back and did it.
The way that you get people to really get into it.
Yes, definitely.
Leaderboard scores.
Yeah, the GIFs are what bring you in. The leaderboards are what keep you hooked.
Totally true.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and it's so satisfying to watch them.
Have you seen solutions that have surprised you? Like things that you just, I saw a butterfly, I think, on the Steam forum. Someone built a butterfly.
Oh,
out of one. Like,
yeah, that's
that
a custom
kind of thing.
Puzzle. Yeah. I'm not a big fan of puzzles where the molecules look like things. It's chemistry.
Oh, yeah?
They're not tiny things. They're like tiny, tiny, tiny things. So
nice. Interesting. Yeah.
Lots of people make things that, like, we have a journal where people can submit puzzles, and, like, a fair number of them are like, look, it looks like blank, and it's like, no, I can't ship this. That would mean that, like, at a tiny level, things look like what they are at a big level, which is kind of appropriate for alchemy, but not the direction I want to take the game in.
That's funny.
People always do stuff that surprise us. In this game, it's largely been stuff that, like, it's not okay. So in InfiniFactory, we had giant rotator arms where people figured out how to build these huge rotating arms, like freely rotating arms that we definitely never planned for, and weird stuff like that. So that was like a really surprising technique. In this game, it's less surprising techniques and just like people doing like things to optimize that we hadn't expected. And so none of them are really fun, though. Like, one of the things that people do is that, like, the game is about building looping solutions, and it turns out that a lot of our, like, pro players have been building solutions where they, like, they just make something that loops, and then they copy and paste it 6 times, so that way they can customize it, because you only have to make 6 things.
Right,
and
right.
So they're sort of, like, hacking around, like, the limitations of the game by, like, making it so it's, okay, I'm just going to build a program that just dumps out exactly what's needed and no more. And then it's just like, oh, so we had, like, a little thing where I accidentally went off on a tangent where I tried to stop this from being a thing, but then it causes like all other kinds of other stuff to break, and it's like, well, I guess this is just part of the game. Like, I don't I'm not sure what we want to do about it yet, you know. It's tough.
So you're like the god getting furious with his creations, and you're like, what are you doing?
Yeah,
I didn't intend for this to happen.
I try not to be like that. Like, you know, obviously you want to embrace when your players find new ways to play your games, you want to embrace it and respond to that, and that's the whole point of early access, but sometimes it's really challenging because it's like, oh god, I did not think of, like, I didn't plan for this. What the fuck am I going to do?
It's difficult. One more thing I want to talk about, Zach, is, so there's been a lot of talk about the video game industry and games as a service and single player games and the idea of the single player game, I don't know about dying, but at the very least going out of fashion. And you guys seem to be thriving, having a small studio, making games, independent games that are very, very niche. And I'm curious about how you guys work that out. And I know you have a parent company, but tell me a little bit about how you guys kind of fit into the industry and how you sustain yourselves making these puzzle games that have very specific audiences.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just that we have a very specific audience. And it turns out that they buy enough of our games that we can...
Works out nicely.
It works out, yeah. And every day I wonder more and more, like, are we even part of the games industry? Like, technically, we're still making games. You could call what we do games, even though they're not like a lot of other games. But just, like, I don't know, right? I would never suggest to somebody else that they should try to copy our business model, right? Because there are other games like ours that come out and they don't do as well. And it's not because they're worse games. It's just because they don't have the audience, right? And it's so much of what we have is probably due to momentum and not like genius strategy. I mean, it's still valuable, right? I mean, like, I think our fans are a huge asset to us, but I guess you have to be aware that it's not because I'm amazing and because, you know, it's not because
of me.
Well,
it could be.
Well,
it could be.
I don't know.
I will say, by the way, that Shenzhen, I think, had a very specific audience and was a little hard to get into if you kind of didn't know what you were getting into. I think that Opus Magnum can be a lot more broadly appealing, and I encourage anyone listening to the show to go check it out because it is incredibly good and addictive, and the feeling of completing this puzzle and watching the pieces just move and whirl around is just very, very satisfying in
There's something very distinctly satisfying about solving a puzzle that after solving it you press a button that then activates your solution and lets you watch it in action. It's actually something that I don't get out of almost any other puzzle games, where usually you solve it and then bing, you see the solution is then entered and you're done. In this case, you don't know that you've solved it until you press play and watch it play, and then it works, and it's a much more satisfying sort of almost physical
feeling. And when you get to that second cycle, you're like, oh yes, I
did
it.
Yes, and then it speeds up. It's very, very, it's almost,
it is very cool.
Yeah, it's very tactile almost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's definitely the hook of Zachtronics games in general, I think. Yeah, Opus Magnum is, we designed it to be more accessible. We didn't necessarily set out initially to make it, but when we realized that was the game we were getting, we just kind of went with it and owned it. And it's definitely the most accessible Zachtronics puzzle game. I'm hoping it's a little bit of like a thing that gets people in the door, you know, and maybe they'll feel more comfortable with a game like Shenzhen.io,
right.
Which is order
you just you have to bring it to the Switch.
Oh God, I don't
you gotta
know.
you gotta I
I'm
know
not
porting
convinced.
Has gotta be super boring. But this game would be perfect on a portable system.
I'm not convinced that Switch players would buy it. I don't really know enough about like the
you
psychology.
Should hear. I've heard so many stories from indie developers who are like, "Yeah, we put our game on Switch, and finally, we're selling copies."
Would it
so
work? Would the interface work on the Switch? I feel like I don't know how it would play on.
Yeah, of course it could.
You'd be dragging a lot of shit out.
I guess
you could use a touchscreen.
Yeah, I think it'd be really annoying to drag. I guess you guys probably are still at the stage where you're dragging instructions out.
Mm-hmm.
But no, the, I'm using keys.
Oh, right, exactly. Yeah, the keyboard shortcuts are what make, like, the you can technically play just by dragging, but the game is very much designed to be played with the keyboard shortcuts.
I'm currently at a place where I say the row of keyboard shortcuts to myself so that I then just can enter them really quickly because I haven't memorized what they all are yet. So I'll say, okay, so now I need to do, you know, S-A-D-D-D-S, and then I go and do that. So I'm not quite there yet, but I will be eventually. That's,
again, Kirk just talks to himself while he plays video games all the time.
Yeah.
All right, Zach, one more thing. What is next for you guys?
Right now, I mean,
other than a Switch port of Opus Magnum,
we're still in early access. So we're adding stuff. We've got some stuff coming out soon, probably after we finish recording this. Honestly,
nice horde mode. I hope it's a horde mode.
Yeah, I hope it's loot crates. Has no zombies, no crates, no none of that.
It's too bad.
That, and then I guess another game after that.
Another esoteric game or another more broadly appealing game?
I think we're going to try to make an MMO this time. I don't know, something with loot crates and, you know.
Okay,
you know,
good.
No,
finally get on the game as get a on the bandwagon.
Yeah, games as a service, like they were meant to be. Yeah. No,
you need to make another Destiny clone. We need more of those.
No, we're not going to make anything like that. Just another Zachtronics game. I mean, I think we're in a nice spot where we can kind of get away with making stuff that, at least to me, find interesting. And and so that's really the thing that behind all our games is I want to make stuff that I'm passionate about and like exploring ideas that I genuinely find interesting. And it's nice to be able to do that as opposed to feel like I have to make stuff that's, you know, just engineered to do well in the minds of people who play games.
Word. Okay, well, thank you so much for being here, Zach. People can find you, of course, at Zachtronics on Twitter, and they can find Opus Magnum on Steam, as well as many of your other games, and soon they'll be able to find Opus Magnum on the Switch. We can't wait.
We should stop
We're looking
that.
Forward to it. We're getting everyone's hopes up. Zach, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
It is the most powerful console ever.
Ever.
The Xbox One X came out this week, and our own Kotaku senior reporter and snack editor Michael Fahey has been playing around with it, wrote a review of it, and is here to talk about it with us right now. Michael, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me, Jason and Kirk.
Good.
It's nice to have you back.
Are you running at 4K resolution right now?
I am. Everything's at 4K resolution and HDR. The range of color is outstanding and amazing.
So do you think the 4K resolution has more, like, is a clearer picture than, say, real life? Like, would you rather be looking at a picture of 4K resolution than something that's in front of you?
There would probably be a lot more details. It is a life-changing resolution upgrade from standard resolution.
Is it actually?
No, not at all.
So yes, I have lots of questions about this console. I, as dedicated split-screen listeners know, have been, both of us, both Kirk and I, have been skeptical of this console since it was announced. We're not sure who it's for.
So I think first we should determine the plural of this for once and for all of this name.
Okay, what is it?
So this was up for some discussion in Kotaku, the Xbox One X. If you have one Xbox One X, you have an Xbox One X. If you have multiple Xbox One X's, how do you say that? I just said Xbox One X's. There's also Xbox. How do you spell it? Is there one S? Is it an ES?
Xbox One's X.
Xbox One's X was put forth, I think, by Cecilia.
Or Xbox's One X.
Xbox's One X, I think, would be my choice.
The real answer is Xbox One X consoles. That
is the answer that Microsoft came back to me with. That was the third most popular choice in our reader poll. But that is what Microsoft said. So Xbox One X consoles for all time. We've now established
that. I'm glad we settled that.
Yeah, I think it was important.
So Mike, so the Xbox One X, just to get the basic facts out of the way, it is a $500 console. It came out this week. It plays all of the same games as the Xbox One, so there are no Xbox One X exclusive games. And it plays also 360 games and even Xbox One games. And by one, I mean Xbox One, not
original
Xbox One. You know what I mean. And it plays them all, or most of them, at higher resolutions, higher frame rates. Tell me about this thing. What does this thing actually offer?
What this thing actually offers is a more powerful alternative to the Xbox One and the Xbox One S. It's a lot like the PlayStation 4.
What does that mean?
Well, it's it it what does that mean? That's a good question, really. What its core difference is, what its aim is to provide stable 4K-ish gameplay and HDR video to the same generation of Xbox One titles that you can play on two other systems. It is an incremental upgrade, sort of like the PlayStation Pro was, PlayStation 4 Pro, to the PlayStation. It adds new features. It has a great deal of power. It sort of harnesses that. And that's what we have. It's it's aimed at people. I mean, one of the core aims is for people who have these HDR 4K televisions, the really expensive televisions. Lots of people are getting 4K TVs because they're so cheap. HDR basically, say, doubles the price of a television at this point. I don't know if a lot of people are adopting it. It's evident in the fact that you can't really share HDR video on the internet without someone who has an HDR monitor, that it's not really integrating well with tech. Eventually, maybe, but right now it's still kind of a niche. Not a lot of people doing it.
Yeah, so, this was something that I thought was interesting about the review, and I also think it's funny that maybe the only possible worst place to try to differentiate with HDR and 4K than in a written article is on a podcast. So I think we're really upping the difficulty for ourselves, but I thought this was an interesting aspect of your review. And something that's been interesting in talking about the PS4 Pro as well is how to convey to people how cool HDR is, because HDR is cool, right, Mike? I mean, it's really nice looking, right?
It's very cool, and what it is essentially is the standard display technology has a limited range between its darkest colors and lightest colors. HDR expands that range, so you have deeper blacks, brighter whites, and more detail in between. The best way to describe it, and I think I pointed this out in the review maybe, is if you're looking at a game with the sun in the sky, on HDR, you'll want to actively squint. It's like having it that bright in your face. But it's not something, like you said, I can't really convey it. I can say it, but unless you're seeing it, it makes no sense whatsoever.
That's what I'm curious about. So as someone who has been using this thing for a week or two, are there any games that you've played using HDR and 4K that have made you go, holy crap, like this is worth buying a $500 console for. This looks incredible.
Well, there's holy crap, and then there's this is worth buying a $500 console for.
Okay.
Two different things. I mean, Forza Motorsport 7, when you're going around the track, the lights are reflecting, the sunlight's reflecting off your car, the sun's in your eyes, and you're almost driving worse because of it. I mean, that's pretty amazing. Some of the Assassin's Creed stuff, even though it kind of it fudges 4K a little bit using a technique called checkerboarding, which basically every other pixel isn't quite rendered, and it's just kind of calculated. Mm-hmm. It's one of the ways that Xbox, the Xbox One X uses for games that are harder to render at full 4K. It looks amazing. It's outstanding. I mean, it's already a beautiful game. You reviewed that, right, Kirk?
Yeah, I mean, it looks great. It looked awesome for me at 1080p with no HDR. I thought it was an extremely beautiful game, so I would imagine, yeah, that it looks very, very nice.
Yeah, I mean, the dust kicks up and the sunlight's going through the dust. The lighting is just
out of control in that game.
Yeah, in HDR, you get a lot more lighting. You get the light coming through the dust, and it's really amazing. But I can play without that, no problem, and not miss it at all.
Yeah, I mean, I've been playing the new DLC for Horizon Zero Dawn, and when I open up that game, I'm just blown away by how good it looks. And I feel like we've hit this point, and we hit this point a while ago, where saying a game has beautiful graphics is no longer even relevant, because every game is just at this point where it looks astounding. And I feel like this arms race for graphical fidelity and resolution and pixel count is, I don't know, it's not really doing much for me.
It's kind of changed, right? I mean, I've been reflecting on this. So I think we talked a lot about this back in 2013, and I know all three of us were there at Kotaku when the PS4 and the Xbox One originally launched. There was a lot of discussion then about pixel counts and about frame rates and about performance and about the PS4s at the time. You know, it had a power advantage over the Xbox One, a slight one, but it had one. And there was this sense that, okay, these two consoles are out neck and neck. One is slightly more powerful than the other one. And if you play whatever it was, Battlefield 4 on the PS4, you're going to get a slightly better looking version of the game. And it felt like that mattered at the time because the two games had pretty much parity at the time in terms of software. And now there's such a different conversation.
Well, it mattered also at the time because you were looking for these two, you were trying to decide which console to buy, and neither of them had good enough exclusives to
justify. So that's what I'm saying. The two consoles had parity in terms of software. I mean, there were a couple exclusives on each one, but the software was about the same. Now, like, because what you're saying is it's true that Horizon Zero Dawn looks really good in 1080p. However, I mean, no, that game also runs at a higher res. I think it runs at 4K or checkerboarded 4K. It has HDR if you have a PS4 Pro. But also, Horizon Zero Dawn cannot be played on an Xbox One. And that's one of many, many games now that aren't on Xbox One. And that seems like that's so significantly changed the conversation that the entire conversation is different. I guess, how do you... You have all the consoles, Fahey, so how do you kind of see the Xbox One X fitting in to your sort of gaming ecosystem?
Okay, well, let's put it this way. Now that I've completed my review of the Xbox One X, it's still hooked up to an HDR 4K TV, and there's a few things I might go back and check out some more, and I'll check out other games as their enhancements get downloaded and see if that changes them significantly, but I'm glad to get back to my PlayStation 4 Pro.
Interesting. Why are you glad to go back to that?
Because it's the game library is what it comes down to. I have a lot more. I mean, my taste lean towards anime-type stuff, RPGs, rhythm games. Right. PlayStation 4 has all of that. The Xbox One X and Xbox in general has a lot of the same standard AAA games, not so many indie games, and an absolute dearth of Japanese imports because the Xbox One's nothing in Japan.
Right.
It's hard to say where the Xbox One X fits in. It wants to be competitive with the PlayStation 4 Pro. You can see that in the specs.
It should be said, I mean, it's a much more powerful console than the PS4 Pro. Well, it's noticeably more, right?
Yeah, it's like 1.4 times more powerful than the PlayStation 4 is what the spec from Microsoft was bandying about. And it does have an Ultra HD Blu-ray player, and the PlayStation 4 Pro does not have that. But it also only plays Xbox games. There's not a lot of them. The exclusives the Xbox One gets aren't, as amazing as, say, Horizon Zero Dawn.
And you can play them on PC, which is, like, how I tend to play most. I really like Forza Horizon 3, for example. I love that game, but I play it on PC. I don't play it on Xbox
One. And the thing is, PC 4K is more powerful on the PC. It's more important on the PC because you are, you sit at a desk, you're a couple feet away from your monitor. So that pixel density makes a big difference. There are charts online that show you the viewing distance for, like, a 55-inch 4K TV for it to make a difference with a human eye. And it's like, you have to be 3.5 feet away for it to really make a difference. And I'm not sitting 3.5 feet away from my 55-inch TV.
Yeah.
But you're also talking about games that are locked on the Xbox as opposed to on the PC, where you have a lot more control over the graphical settings and your ability to uncap the frame rate, say.
Well, it's a blessing and a curse, really, because that's a reason a lot of people use consoles instead of PCs, because they know they put a game in a console, it's going to play a certain way.
Yeah.
Whereas a PC, I mean, I've got a 1080 Ti from NVIDIA, GTX 1080 Ti. I can run some games in 4K really great, and other games won't. So when you get a console, you at least know you're going to have a consistent experience, at least between the three different Xboxes that there are.
So I want to ask about the Xbox One X specifically. So we can get back to the comparisons, but if I am in the market, let's say I'm a split screen listener who really wants this thing for whatever reason. I'm an Xbox fan. I want to play Halo 5, gorgeous looking Halo 5, like up res, whatever. Having played it and been using it for a while, would you say that there's anything that any surprises, anything that was surprised you about the console in a positive way, or anything that surprised you in a negative way? Or would you say that it is the box we expected? It is just a more powerful Xbox, just as Microsoft had promised.
It comes down to the individual games themselves and how the developers utilize the enhanced power of the Xbox One X. Halo 5 Guardians runs at 4K 60 frames per second. Which is great if you have a 4K TV. If you don't, it's still Halo. It will down a super sample the 4K resolution, the textures, down to 1080p, which will lead to less aliasing, so the curves won't be as jaggy. But it's not that great of an improvement. Then you have a game like Ark Survival Evolved. Their enhanced version, there's a 1080p version, which runs at 60 frames per second, and then there's a 1440p. Now, not a lot of people know that the Xbox One X does support 2K,
right?
Which, you know, the lower the resolution you go, the better a game performs. So the Ark system, the Ark Survival Evolved has a 1440p mode that runs at 30 frames per second, but has an enhanced view distance, better textures, dynamic weather, which is something they have on PC that they haven't had on consoles. So it depends on how the game uses the extra power. So it's not really so much, wow, the Xbox One is powerful, as is, you know, Ark Survival Evolved is really great on the Xbox One X.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a case-by-case sort of thing, which makes it even more difficult to say, hey, go buy an Xbox One X.
Yeah, one of the comparisons you did in your review was with another console that I don't have, which is the Xbox One S, which came out, I guess, last year or 2 years ago? Came out
in November, you know, last year.
Last year. So something it came like out that. After the Xbox One, before the Xbox One X. I still have an original Xbox One back from when I reviewed that console and didn't get an S. But it sounds like the S has a surprising number of features that the X has, which has always been kind of a head-scratcher for me. Like, it has the Ultra HD Blu-ray player, right? And it can stream 4K HDR content. So that, again, muddies the water and makes it a little more like, oh, this is an incremental increase that, yes, is very powerful, but has not maybe yet made the case for itself as this essential purchase.
Right, and I say if you have an Xbox One S, unless you have a TV that does 4K and HDR, stick with the Xbox One S.
Mm-hmm.
What really drove it home for me, or the incremental nature of the upgrade, I like to compare it to an iPhone upgrade. I got the Xbox One X. I unplugged my Xbox One S, plugged in the brand new console. It's black and sleek and neat, and powered it on. And there's like this little roar at the beginning that goes 4K. And then it's just an Xbox. It's an Xbox. It's like getting a new iPhone. You're like, wow, this is cool. And look how sleek the design is. And power it on. And oh, there's Candy Crush.
That's your same apps.
Right. Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. And so it seems like the Xbox One X is still just designed for a very specific group of people, people who are big Xbox fans and have 4K TVs.
I should say that PS4 Pro felt very similar to me when I got that. And I think I didn't review it exactly, but I covered it for us. I handled it when it came out. And it was the same feeling of, okay, I did a system transfer and I turned it on and it sure is a PS4.
I wonder if this is like more of a future-proofing thing than something that is actually going to be very beneficial to you now. So maybe in 2 years when the PS5 and Xbox 2 aren't out yet.
Oh, God.
But games are still coming out and there are still a lot of like games that could look incredibly good, and maybe they look fine on a PS4 and Xbox One S, but they look really good on a PS4 Pro and Xbox One X. I don't know. I mean, right now, like if someone asked me what console to get, I'd probably say Switch. But beyond that, if they said they wanted to play like the big third-party AAA games, Star Wars Battlefront, etc., I would probably say get a PS4, because if you do that, then you're also getting better first-party exclusives. So I just don't know why anyone would get a PS4 Pro or Xbox One X at this point. I mean, I just don't see it. I don't see the audience.
Yeah, if someone had no console at all right now, and they did have an HDR TV and a 4K TV, and they said, I have no console, I want to play a system with the most games, I want to play... That's PlayStation. It's hands-down PlayStation.
Right.
The Xbox One's been struggling to keep up with the PlayStation since 2013. And it's almost as if Microsoft... I mean, PlayStation's had two iterations, but Microsoft's done three, and it's almost as if, you know, they brought their, I said this earlier to Kirk, they brought their sandwich to the sandwich building contest, and they're like, nope, yours isn't good enough, and they're like, okay, hold on a second, they lift the bread up and throw some more stuff in there, and they're like, how about now, and they're like, not quite, and they're like, be right back, Here we go.
Add another layer.
Four times the meat. How about now? I'm like, it's still the same sandwich, but
it's just bigger.
Okay.
Well, yeah. they ditched the connect part of the sandwich. I guess the old the sandwich. Like,
that's true.
The old it had a weird meatball.
The sandwich no longer watches you while you eat it.
It had pickles on it or something, and they got rid of the motion control pickles.
Well, it's so interesting. It's been so interesting watching this kind of console war since 2013 because Xbox and Microsoft started so poorly out the gate with the whole DRM thing and the 180. Ooh. And to those of you, some people might have started gaming and missed that whole thing because it was already 4 years ago. But basically, Microsoft had this big lofty plan for the Xbox. People were so mad about the way that they presented it that they had to backtrack. And then they sold the system for $100 higher than the PS4. And long story short, the PS4 just doubled sales of the Xbox right out of the gate. And it got to the point where Microsoft doesn't even say how many Xboxes they've sold anymore because they're so embarrassed about that number compared to the PS4. They're so getting blown out of the water that they don't even say it anymore. But instead of like shifting in another direction and making, say, a system that was like a living room PC, Microsoft just doubled down on this super niche group of like people who are obsessed with power and pixel count and resolution. And that just seems so, I don't know, short-sighted to me. I just don't get it.
And now 4 years later, we have two consoles capable of 4K HDR play. The Xbox One is $100 more than the PlayStation One.
Yeah, it's kind of the same landscape.
That is
really.
Funny. Yeah, so the PS4 Pro is $400 and this is $500?
Yeah.
Wow.
So we're back to square one.
Yeah, but at least last time you were paying $100 more for something that was less powerful. This time you're paying $100 more for something that is more powerful, significantly more powerful.
That is PS4 Pro.
Don't discount being able to run your cable box through your console, Jason.
That was so funny. That and the Kinect and just so many other things. They kept talking about the cloud and gaming through the cloud. And the example that they brought up was Crackdown 3. And Crackdown 3, still not out, was actually supposed to come out this week tied to the Xbox One X, but did not make it. It's delayed until next year. And it just seems like Microsoft has been floundering. They've had to cancel so many of their games from Phantom Dust to Scalebound, and they closed studios. They closed Lionhead, the makers of Fable. It just seems like this company does not have like a mandate or a vision. And that's not to say that Sony is doing things perfectly. I mean, every E3 and Sony conference for the past 3 years has featured the same five games that they keep showing over and over again. But at least Sony has embraced enough exclusives and made their console desirable enough that, I mean, they're clearly winning because that console is a better place to play games right now, unless you're really into Forza and Halo and Gears of War, or unless you have one of those Scorpio symbols on your Twitter handle.
And then also we have the Switch, which came out this year. It was this year, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I know. It feels like I've had it forever. It's like an old friend.
Yeah, yep. 40 years ago.
But I noted this in my review. The Switch comes along. It's running games in handheld mode at 720p. Yeah. And everyone's like, well, these games are amazing. And you're like, maybe 4K is not the way to go here. Maybe make some good games.
Yeah.
And if you have those, people will play them no matter what resolution they're at. No, we're going to go 4K? Okay, thanks.
Yeah, so ultimately, who do you think should get an Xbox One X, Mike? Like, what sort of, if I'm in the market for a console or whatever, like, what sort of desire does this fill? If you have a 4K TV and you really want to play Assassin's Creed and make it look as pretty as possible?
Tough call. Well, see, if you have a 4K HDR TV, that's a big distinction.
Yeah, I keep forgetting that difference between eight. It's so confusing.
Because if you just want to run some things at 4K, the Xbox One S will upscale. It's not perfect, but it's still going to give you the same games running at pseudo 4K, but still relatively at the speed as if they were running at 1080. Mm-hmm. Which is weird. I mean, the Xbox One S also has the Blu-ray player, so I can't say, hey, you could pick up the Xbox One X for the Ultra HD Blu-ray player, you know, or you could just keep the Xbox One S, get that for $250, which is, you know, half the price of the bigger system.
Yeah.
It really, you have to kind of be a diehard Xbox fan.
Well, that, and or even just someone who has had Xbox games for a long time, right? I mean, that is somebody that this is sort of for. Like, if you have a huge library of Xbox, original Xbox games and Xbox 360 games, and you've been, you know, you've got a, you've had a gamer tag and a gamer score, and all your friends are on Xbox, and that was, you know, where you've been playing games for a long time. I could see if you didn't get an Xbox One S, and you, maybe money isn't that big a deal to you, or it's the extra $100 isn't a big deal. And you just decide, yeah, all right, I'm going to get this one now. I haven't gotten a new console
in a while. The 360 games are a big deal. I think that's a really big benefit. You can play Red Dead Redemption on this console.
This is like the only...
So have you played... Do 360 games look much better on the Xbox One X?
They look a little... They have to be specifically enhanced for them to look a great deal better. Mm-hmm. Though, what was I playing the other day? Ilo Milo.
Yeah, oh, that's a great game.
I love that game so much, and that's one of the only Xbox 360 games I have on here. But it was from, those games are all from a much better time. It felt like a lot of those came out when the Xbox was at the top of its game, the Xbox 360. And back in that generation, I remember my PlayStation gathering dust for the most the most amount of time. What word am I looking for?
The lion's share. Okay, that works.
The lion's share of that generation belonged to the Xbox 360 for me.
Yes.
Towards the end, the PlayStation 3 came in and was like, wait a minute, what about me? And by the end of that generation, I was totally on the PlayStation 3.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a weird shift. But going back to those games, it's like, yeah, I remember this. I remember those blades. I remember going in and, oh... I remember when I got my first HD TV, which was still 5x4 and ran everything in a really tiny letterbox on an already tiny screen. And you know, that brings me back. If you have a library of Xbox One games or Xbox 360 games or original Xbox games now, if you can't wait to play Sudeikis in 4K, then hey, get this system. Eventually you can play Sudeikis in pseudo 4K, upscaled, downscaled, super sampled, whatever.
All right, one more question and then we got to run. So Mike, does the Xbox One X do anything? Does it improve things at all if I don't have a 4K TV, if I just have a regular old 1080p TV?
It will on a game-by-game basis.
Oh, that's the answer to everything, huh?
It's really the answer to everything. It depends on the games. Microsoft has an extensive list of enhanced games, and you can go through there and see what game's doing what. Games that aren't enhanced can still benefit from better loading times.
Right, right.
And that sort of thing.
Isn't it like if a game has an unlocked frame rate, sometimes they just will run right at 60 instead of sort of in the 40 to 60 zone?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm. All right, Mike, thank you so much for coming on the show, as always. People can find you at Kotaku on Twitter at BunnySpatial. And we will see you next time. Next time there's some, I don't know, anime games for you to talk about.
Or some snack food.
Snacks.
Sure.
Snacks. We can eat some anime games. We'll be back to eat some anime games here on Split Screen.
Eat some anime games at 4K HDR.
Mm-hmm.
See if I eat.
All right. Goodbye, Mike.
Later, guys.
All right, those are some fun interviews, Kirk, but I think it is time for us to say goodbye.
I think that it is. That was plenty of good content for everybody for this week.
Plenty of delicious content.
The tastiest content.
So we will be back next week to talk about some other things. And
more
then,
games.
Man, it's almost Thanksgiving. I can't believe Thanksgiving is like in 2 weeks.
I'm happy, man. I feel like there's more games to talk about for sure. And then we kind of enter that end of the year period and we can start doing all that good, juicy end-of-year content, which I'm very excited
about. Yeah, so people can look forward to our predictions, going over this year's predictions and seeing who won.
Mm-hmm.
And people can look forward to our annual tradition of going through every single video game released in 2017.
Every single one. It's going to be great.
It will be great. All right, Kirk, I'll see you next week.
All right, see you then. Kotaku Split Screen is an official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Jason Schreier and me, Kirk Hamilton. I edit and mix the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. We're part of the Fusion Podcast Network, where Mandana Mofidi is executive producer of audio. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR Now, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts, and we hope that you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.